You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora, tēnā koutou katoa, ko Hayden Tokawingawa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Jasmine. Efa Akene coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about the recent Labour Party annual general meeting, scrutiny week, and the government's proposed 4% rates rise cap. For International Desk, I spoke to American University Provost Associate Professor Garrett Grady Lovelace about the level of food waste caused by Trump administration policies and the significant consequences of this. And I spoke to Professor Mehana Juri, WPSI 2025 co-chair, about his reflections from the conference. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
Today, I also talked to Councillor Julie Ferry about the government's proposed rates cap, as well as action on youth homelessness and the upcoming opening of the Sky City Convention Centre. I spoke to Dr. Alex Beattie about his thoughts on the incoming under-16 social media ban in Australia and what it means for us here in Aotearoa. And I also spoke to Dr. Ying Wang about her research into the increased need for support for Asian communities in the sexual violence support sector.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Ka awa e wariwari yahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero ano, he pakihere rukiruki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o Erarangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM Erakatikom. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Last week, the Labour Party hosted their annual general meeting in Auckland. When asked what has changed for the party since the last election, leader Chris Hipkins says the party has a fresh focus and fresh faces. This week is the second scrutiny week of the year in Parliament, focused on scrutinising government spending throughout this year. Questions range from focusing on outcomes, the sustainability of budgets, and politically contentious topics. And the government has announced a 4% council rates rise cap. The rates cap will be a variable target band and enforced by a new regulator. However, the cap has already been criticised by Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown, who says it won't work and ignores local government's own insights on their budget and infrastructure needs. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking if Labour's AGM set the tone for next year's election campaign.
Certainly there was a lot of vibe. The sun was out in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland, and we had an overwhelming response of members that attended our AGM this year. So it was a really big weekend. It was warm, it was celebratory. Most of all, the energy was really high. There's a lot of motivation to change the government, and so people are wanting to get involved in that.
Is it a sign of what's to come that Labour has taken some branding inspiration from Zoran Mamdani's campaign?
I haven't heard that myself, but certainly that was a successful campaign. Labour's campaign is focused on jobs, health and homes. I think those are really critical issues to the issues that every New Zealander is facing and the challenges that they're experiencing with the cost of living that the government promised to fix and they just haven't. New Zealanders have really had enough. They want to change the government now. And so the weekend was a really good opportunity to set the scene, to look into 2026 and commit to two ticks for Labour in 26.
You posted about a meeting of Rainbow Labour at the AGM. Can you talk more about this perspective, especially given the government's recent puberty blockers announcement?
We had the largest turnout of Takapapui Rainbow members than we've had in any other AGM in the time I've spent in Labor. So that was really heartening for everyone to be able to come together in solidarity and, yes, in response to the kickdown that this government has given on our Rainbow community. And the weeks lead up where the government chose to restrict access for trans and non-binary rangatahi to puberty blockers is an example that has motivated people in our Labor community to do the work and get on with changing the government in 2026 so that young people can have access to the healthcare that they deserve.
And what are the major topics coming out of Scrutiny Week this week?
It's been a big, long week in Scrutiny Week. I've been in tertiary education and the education committees for the last 2 days. And really, we're challenging the government on things like continued poor delivery of the school lunch programs after the government made cuts, the curriculum NCEA refresh that has been designed overseas, not by New Zealanders, and the poor response from the government to the concerns that are being raised. I also see that there's been issues around housing where Chris Bishop hasn't been upfront and honest with the public, and Mark Mitchell hasn't been able to deliver on the 500 new police on the beat that this government promised. So, you know, those are all examples where the government, with their slogans and all, have really under-delivered, and instead New Zealanders are going backwards.
I know you questioned Vocational Education Minister Penny Simmons on Tuesday on your select committee. Can you talk more about what you asked her and her response?
Well, the challenge for New Zealand at the moment is that we have hit a peak of 90,000 young people not engaged in education, training or employment. That is the size of Palmerston North. And so my questions to the minister was, what was she doing about that, given the low number of apprenticeships, given the low number of access to foundation learning? And she didn't have any answers. So I'll continue to challenge her on that. 90,000 young people is a lot of...
Overall, has it been a tense atmosphere in Parliament this week?
Certainly the government is feeling the pressure. When they haven't delivered on the things that they promised, when the economy is going backwards, that they feel under pressure. And it's our job as a good opposition to hold them to account for the decisions that they have made that they haven't been able to deliver on, and will continue to do that.
And moving to local government, what do you think of the government's proposed rate cap?
The rates cap is out of touch. It's a nice idea where people don't want to pay more rates, but the reality under national government and Christopher Luxon is that things are getting more expensive for the average New Zealander, unless you're in the top wealth category of New Zealand. We know that access to public transport has got more expensive, the cost of petrol, the ability to use your car. And so this is another expense that will be offset into the average New Zealanders having to pay for their very basic services in their community.
But rates are becoming increasingly unaffordable for many households. Does something need to be done about this?
Certainly they need to be monitored. But every council has an election. People get to choose at a local level what their priorities are. A one-size-fits-all blanket rule across all across all areas in New Zealand isn't going to work. The government needs to get in touch with those communities. You've seen Mayor Wayne Brown absolutely in outrage on this decision, because one of those are actually the water infrastructure that that we need to pay for, that will be offset and increased as a result. And, you know, the government needs to be in touch with what people are doing here.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on the recent Labour Party annual general meeting, Scrutiny Week, and the government's proposed 4% rate rise cap.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Councilling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Tāmaki Makaurau's council budget is among those impacted by the proposal of a rates cap, considering Tāmaki's average 5.8% annual rates increase across the 25-26 financial year. Youth homelessness is a growing concern as discussions continue around move-on orders for those without housing in Auckland CBD, and the Sky City Convention Centre is set to open in 2026 with high hopes for what it may bring for Tāmaki Makaurau after its prolonged development. I spoke to Councillor Ferry about these topics. Morena Julie, what are your thoughts on the central government's proposal of a rates cap?
Well, I think it's a really short-sighted idea that doesn't actually understand how local government works, that doesn't acknowledge that local government councils heavily consult on their budgets and on their rates increases before they adopt them, and get a whole bunch of community input before those decisions are made, that unlike central government, which does its budgets without consultation, even with sometimes MPs in the governing party, sometimes it's just cabinet decisions, our budgets and rates increases go through a very long, rigorous process, and there is a constant focus on keeping the rates as low as possible. A rates cap will mean severe underfunding for councils, and we've seen that overseas, as close as Australia, where it has disabled councils from making the investments that they need to in infrastructure. It has meant they can't keep up maintenance and things like that. And, just really short-sighted and shows a complete lack of understanding or indeed respect for the sector and the fact that communities actually get a say in the rates increases and how they're set. Auckland also has a history of having actually quite low rates increases compared to the rest of the country, and also delivers really good value for those rates. I have friends who live in other parts of the country who are like, wow, you get a lot more for your rates for the same amount that they get in other areas. So even if you could mount an argument about some other parts of the country, and I don't think you can, even if you could, there's certainly a very, very considered approach to rates in Auckland. Nobody really wants to put them up. And so there's always a discussion about how do we keep them as low as possible.
Earlier this week, Manaaki Rangatahi presented to Parliament Ministers about support for youth homelessness. How does Auckland Council address support for those without housing in the Rangatahi demographic specifically, especially amidst the discussions of incoming move-on Aucklanders possible in the CBD?
Yeah, so this is something that is going to sit with the committee that I'll be chairing this term around the community committee picks up the issue of homelessness. It used to be dealt with through the regulatory committee and more through a sort of bylaw legalistic sort of framework. And last term, with the agreement of the chair of that committee, Joe Bartley, we shifted it to the community committee so it could be a more compassionate response that acknowledges that this is often about disconnection, isolation, discrimination, and poverty at the end of the day. And also has a link through to our ongoing housing crisis, particularly for those who are who have low incomes or indeed no income, who can't access affordable housing even for rent. So it's a really complex problem, and I think the response of central government to look at move-on orders is, I think I described it to someone as it's a little bit like Alexander cutting the Gordian knot, for those who remember their classical education. So the idea is that no one can untangle this Gordian knot, it's too hard. And so Alexander the Great just slices through it with his sword and is like, well, that's fixed. And actually, this is something where we actually need to very carefully unpick it, because the move-on orders, the slicing it through, actually doesn't solve the problem. It just moves it, and in many cases it will actually mean that rangatahi in particular are unfairly targeted on the street. Often they are not the perpetrators of antisocial behaviour on the street, they are the victims. And this kind of approach doesn't acknowledge that. So I'm working with our council staff to understand exactly what we do in this space already, that it's been ongoing for some time. We work with a lot of the key agencies like Kickback, who supported the who produced the report recently that shows really stark and depressing stats around young people on the street. We work with Kahui Te Kaha, who are one of the main agencies providing wraparound services, and Housing First, which is the way that is the government central government supported scheme actually that works with agencies like City Mission and LifeWise to get people, not just young people, but anyone who is finds themselves living on the street, into housing, acknowledging that having secure, stable housing that suits their needs is the first step in resolving the often really complex web of need that that person has. They might have issues around mental health or addiction or abuse or, you know, being able to get an income, those kinds of things. So we get them into housing, and then that forms a stable basis from which to address other issues. And what would be amazing would be more government support for that, because everybody knows, everybody in the sector, overseas research, everything tells us that those kinds of community-based agency approaches work. Getting police or council officers, which we don't want to have council officers doing the move-on orders, but getting them in there with an authoritarian approach, moving people on, is just going to make things so much worse and make people who are already vulnerable even more at risk.
And the opening of the Sky City Convention Centre is approaching for Tāmaki also. What is the ripple effect that you're expecting for the city?
Well, it's going to be quite interesting because in theory it should mean that we can attract more of these large international conventions that bring a lot of visitors into the city, including many from overseas, and that should have a knock-on effect for retail, for hospitality, for accommodation and all of that kind of stuff, particularly in the city centre, and those will have ripple effects out. So it's really an economic thing. But one thing I wanted to point out about this is that this was all set up before lockdowns, before COVID, and there has been a change in the convention industry about not necessarily travelling as far, doing more things online. So we'll be interested to see how that pans out. The other thing that people have forgotten about the convention centre deal is that that was when that was done, which I think, if I remember correctly, was back in about 2012, central government agreed to give Sky City a whole lot more pokies, so gambling machines, which are the most addictive gambling machines, as a trade-off for them building this convention centre. So they've now had something like 10, 12 years of these pokie machines bringing in additional revenue for them, potentially creating additional harm in terms of addiction, and we still don't have our convention centre. So I just wanted to take the opportunity to raise that because that was something that the community was really concerned about at the time, and that was when the convention centre was going to be open much, much earlier. So they've had the benefit from their point of view of those additional pokies this whole time. The community has had the impact, the negative impact of those pokies for that whole time, and we are finally getting the convention centre that was traded off for them next year. So, yeah, we'll see. I'm really hoping it is good because we've paid a lot for it as a city and in the harm that those pokies have caused. And I think there's a lot of hope around it. So I really hope that that does come to fruition.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on a nationally standardised rates cap, action on youth homelessness in Auckland, and the impact of the Sky City Convention Centre on Tāmaki Makaurau, which is set to open next year.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts 5395. This is Sharon Van Etten's For You.
Thank you.
Five, four, three, two, one.
International desk.
Our go.
The Trump administration has caused issues of significant food waste due to a broad range of policies, including immigration raids, tariffs, cuts to food assistance programs, and the destruction of food for programs like USAID. This has had huge consequences, including environmental impacts, as well as impacts on the estimated more than 47 million people in the US who don't have enough food to eat, and those who have relied on US foreign aid that has been cut. For International Desk, I spoke to Garrett Grady Lovelace, Provost Associate Professor in Environment, Development and Health at American University, about these issues. I started by asking if she could outline the Trump administration's policies that have had an impact on food waste, especially ones we might not think about.
Yes, thank you. Kia ora, and so nice to be in conversation with people across the ocean in this very important time. I will preface by saying the United States, Turtle Island, is in a moment of deep repression, and a lot of our community, who are immigrants, are under surveillance. And so even just having communication and correspondence with people around the world is important. You know, that's actually what this administration is trying to do, is isolate those of us in this country and in these lands. So it's just really good to be in dialogue. So there's so many angles to this. And I wrote this little essay, and it was like a 5,000 word essay, and the editor said, you have to cut it down. So thank you for asking, because there's so many ways that the alleged efficiency, the alleged Department of Government efficiency, the DOGE, notorious DOGE, really kind of campaign, ended up destroying so many aspects of governance. And so one of the things that's most salient is USAID. So the US had this Agency for International Development, which frankly was imperfect. You know, a lot of us within the US had been critiquing USAID. It has a history that is conducive to US imperial, you know, geopolitics. However, that being said, over the decades and generations, there have been really good people who've gone to work at USAID, who are very authentically committed to anti-hunger and to supporting communities around the world who are facing extreme hunger and extreme poverty. So it was actually at this point really a space of moving a lot of resources, HIV medicines, a lot of food for communities facing famine, a lot of vaccines, a lot of public health resources. And in fact, the USAID had gotten so conscientious about supporting women-led communities, gender diversity, communities in the African continent, that's why the USAID was targeted, you know. So let's not, you know, lose sight of the fact that it's because there were so many conscientious people who had started working at USAID over the years and really made what was originally kind of an imperial agency into something that was really supportive and built, frankly, in a lot of lines of solidarity, that it was so radically defunded. Now, when Trump was elected in November 2024, many of us knew that climate research would be, you know, defunded, that public health research would be defunded, that anti-hunger work, international and domestic, would be defunded, environmental work would be defunded, racial justice work, gender equity work would be defunded. We didn't know it would be deleted and criminalized. You know, so the layer of attacks. So I have colleagues who worked at USAID who said that they worked there for 30, 40 years. And within hours, armed guards told them to leave them and all of their work and all of their files behind. And so at that point, you had enormous quantities of food, ready-to-use biscuits, which are like emergency food aid, in various storehouses around the world. And the people who were in charge of circulating, distributing that, were all fired on en masse. And so, you know, it expired. And so it was 500 tons of these high-energy biscuits, which are for people on the ground who are facing not only just famine, but displacement, like the Palestinian people facing genocide. And so all of that had to be destroyed. And in fact, another 125,000 taxpayer money was used to incinerate it. So that was 70,000 tons of USAID food aid that was destroyed. Meanwhile, there was a lot of domestic food, food aid through the Emergency Food Aid Program, TFAP, And hundreds of millions of pounds of that was also rotted in trucks when that was defunded in the spring. ProPublica had a reporting on that. So all the food aid, domestic and international, there was a massive defunding and a firing, and that rotted on site. That's just one of many.
This is a really interesting point, and I want to go into this further, because can you talk about the number of people who are now going hungry because of these policies, both in the US, but also in the places that have suffered from US aid cuts?
Yes, thank you for that. So I should say, clearly, the Trump regime, for all of its problems, did not originate, the issue of food insecurity. And in fact, already there was 44 million people in the U.S., which is one of the richest countries in the world, who were facing such intense food insecurity that they rely upon the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. SNAP is the acronym, which is food aid, domestic food aid. And so now that number, they think, is up to 47 million, maybe higher. A lot of people don't report. And many people who are themselves either in vulnerable migration status, or if they have documentation, someone in their family is undocumented, which often happens, they do not self-report hunger or food insecurity, nor do they reach out for these support services. So the number of people in the U.S. facing hunger is actually substantially higher than 47 million people, the experts say. So the SNAP distribution, the Trump administration in the summer of 2025 instituted the big bill, which was an omnibus bill that cut SNAP significantly. And we can talk about the details of how they did it. But they waited for it to kick in until after the midterm election so that the Democrats would be blamed. It's a very kind of Machiavellian move. Nevertheless, once this fall happened with the shutdown, the Republicans decided to take that advantage to cut SNAP and then blame the Democrats. This is kind of a game, you know, that's being played with SNAP as the pawn of the game. And so many places around the world, rural and urban, indigenous, people in the Delta, people in cities and urban cities who desperately need this food aid, particularly as the winter months get colder and as whatever kind of summer vegetables or summer produce stops being available. So the need is very high in late autumn, which is exactly when the SNAP cuts happened. We're facing a few weeks without the resources that they needed. Those have been reinstated to some degree. However, now what's happened is the U.S. administration, the Trump administration, has requested data on every single SNAP recipient, which is a way to kind of surveil, control, make sure anyone who has immigration, family members are kind of under the ICE, the Immigration Customs and Enforcement, Border Patrol, dragnet. And the states that have said we are not going to give that data to the federal government, which are largely Democrat states, led states, just yesterday, the Trump regime said, we will withhold SNAP benefits if you don't give us all of the sensitive data. So all of these kind of, very, very clever and manipulative ways to kind of use SNAP for political gain. On the international level, this is so hard to count because, kind of tracking where those food biscuits would have gone, that would have fed tens of thousands of people. You had other cuts to broader food aid programs where they were procuring domestic production and then circulating those international various food for peace programs, PO480, food for progress programs. And those have also been cut and defunded. At this point, estimates would be hundreds of thousands, if not more, people around the world who would have been benefiting from food aid through these U.S. channels don't have it. Now, the goal is for people not to be dependent on U.S. food aid, but we can talk about the broader, the U.S. has actually constructed a dependence on U.S. aid and U.S. Exports. That's a very calculated move that the U.S. government has recorded since the 1950s, making sure that people around the world are dependent upon U.S. food, as a geopolitical manipulation. So it's a tragedy that people were so dependent, but now that's been cut off, and it's this kind of double tragedy.
As you say, there are so many different elements to this, but there is something else I wanted to ask about, and that's the amount of food waste, especially in places like farms. Can you speak to this issue and how it's gotten worse under Trump?
Yes, and thank you for that. So already before the Trump administration, the estimate was that 40% of edible food in the U.S. is wasted, is not making its way all the way to someone's body, to someone's, you know, mouth or meal. So this is already an enormous issue. And this is happening at the consumer level. This is happening at the corporate supply chain level. This is happening at the restaurant level, cafeterias, as well as on the farm. And on the farm, it's called food loss. And then it's food waste once it's in the distribution system. And so a lot of this is happening in household, but also corporate and in grocery stores. And whenever there's a disruption of the supply chain, it gets worse. And so what the Trump regime has done is it's been a massive disruptor. You know, so you will have tariffs, for instance, which cut off trade flows. And again, the trade flows were not perfect. But once you cut them off, you know, immediately, then you've got a backup and kind of a glut. In the article, I talked about soy, which was not destined for humans. That was destined for Chinese swine industry. So there's a level of, like, it was waste to begin with to have all of that arable land grow food and water for Chinese, pig industry. But on the other hand, even the food is not able to be circulated because other countries are retaliating against the U.S. tariffs. So that creates a backlog. But also importantly, farm labor. So there are huge raids right now. Even ICE came to our campus, near our campus today, American University in DC. And ICE, they're masked, they're highly armed. They frankly are kind of a neo-militia. These are racist militias. And they storm places of work to kind of both arrest people whom they say are undocumented or don't have the right documentation, but also to kind of terrorize. There's a psychological element to this. And it is very racialized. It's very based on racial profiling. And so what's happening is that because so much of the U.S. food industry, the specialty crops, which is the fresh produce and vegetables, are hand harvested and hand grown by immigrant farm workers who are already underpaid, face pesticide exposure, face sexual violence in the field, face smoke from the fire. So already farm workers have an extremely notorious working conditions. But now you have ICE militias circling their places of work and the meatpacking places where it's mostly immigrant labor and migrant labor, and making these raids, some of which have led to lethal consequences and family separations. And so, of course, people are terrified to go to work. And so there's been very little data collected on the aggregate. So we had to kind of use anecdote for this essay and just kind of find, you know, as many reports as we can and compile them. But we know it's bad because even the U.S. government's Department of Labor admitted in a report that the ICE arrests and immigration, you know, quote unquote, enforcement was having such an impact that there was mass wastage of food on the farm level, on the field level, and that this could disrupt U.S. food security. So this was the Trump administration admitting to itself that there was a problem and a disconnect here. So what we need is more research on it, but they have fired the people at the USDA who would do this research. So we're in kind of a data blackout right now. They even fired and deleted the Food Insecurity Survey this summer, which for a generation has been collecting household food insecurity levels. The whole survey's gone. So it's an excellent question, and we are working with farm organizations and farm work organizations to aggregate what we can, but we do know that it's a problem, even to the point that the Trump administration is concerned.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but are there any conclusions you want to draw to end the interview based on all the different threads of this broad issue?
Yes, thank you for that. So the major takeaway is that this administration thinks of people and food and communities as disposable. You know, this mass waste comes about because this administration thinks of human labor and human lives and human communities, which comprise the food systems, as expendable, as fungible, as arrestable, as killable. So there's a broader problem of a lack of value and a systemic devaluation of food systems, the people who comprise food systems, the eaters, the workers, the growers. So food waste and wasted food is a problem, but it's a symptom of very troubling larger problems.
That was American University Provost Associate Professor Garrett Grady Lovelace on the level of food waste caused by Trump administration policies and the significant consequences of this.
The International Desk on 95BFM.
The Wire.
Australia's national under-16 social media ban will be officially enforced as of Friday next week, with huge disruptions for rangatahi across the ditch. The responses included two Australian teens, Noah Jones and Macy Neeland, backed by rights organisation Digital Freedom Project, who have challenged the legislation in the High Court with a staunch response from their federal government. I spoke to Dr. Alex Beattie, Senior Lecturer in Information Management at Victoria's University of Wellington, about his concerns for how the legislation regards rangatahi and their digital rights and the likelihood of Aotearoa following suit. What alternative means do you think would be effective in comparison to a blanket ban for Australia and for youth anywhere?
So we should be talking about children's digital rights instead of digital prohibition. My concern about a ban is that it asks all 16-year-olds and younger to change the way they socialise using media, which just isn't feasible because we have to acknowledge that media is a part of young people's lives. We should be advocating for more children's rights, protecting them from algorithmic targeting, addictive design, stripping all those things away from the platforms. And I think that would be a much longer, sustainable form of regulation than a ban, which is a band-aid solution.
And you touched on it there also, but how does this action regard the agency of rangatahi aged under 16 as a stakeholder group in this situation?
Well, there's no consultation with young people. There's no asking 16-year-olds and younger, what are your digital needs? This is just the perspective of parents and older people, and that really leaves us vulnerable to nostalgia, parents wanting younger people the same kind of like pre-digital childhood, which just isn't realistic. It's not today. It's just a pipe dream. There is no consultation with young people. So they're losing their agency. They're losing their ability to learn how to navigate online, how to navigate these tricky issues. You know, literacies, navigating on the online world is a skill. It's something that you learn over time. And if we stop people's ability to do that until they're 17, then are we actually preparing them for navigating the online world? No, we're not.
And what do you think the likelihood is that Aotearoa follows suit on something like this?
That is the million-dollar question. You know, next week, when Australia implements the ban, the world will be watching how they do it and what the kind of impact is on young people. It's a really interesting question here. My understanding is National really likes it. ACT doesn't because it infringes on young people's, you know, freedom of expression online. So there seems to be a lack of support on the coalition. So we just have to wait and see. And it's actually also kind of unclear what Labor's position is on it. I think Greens are against, but we don't quite know what the political kind of take on it across the whole spectrum of New Zealand. So it's a bit of wait and see.
And what will you be watching for as this under 16 social media ban rolls out?
Well, I'll be looking at the impact on young people, whether or not this actually improves people's mental health, because that's the whole reason behind the ban. And there's a lot of genuine concern and goodwill behind the ban, even though I don't agree with it. I agree with people that are concerned about young people's mental health. So will this actually make a positive impact? I have my doubts, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
That was Dr. Alex Beattie, Senior Lecturer in Information Management at Victoria University of Wellington, regarding his concerns about the incoming social media ban for those under 16 in Australia and what the impacts may be for Aotearoa.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. This is Paul by Big Thief.
Oh, the last time I saw Paul, I was horrible and almost let him in. But I stopped and caught the wall, and my mouth got dry, so all I did was take him for a spin. Yeah, we hopped inside my car. Thank you. said that you'd take me any way I came or went, but I'll push you from my brain. See, your gentle baby, I couldn't stay.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
WIPSI, or the World Indigenous Peoples Conference on Education, is a triennial conference that celebrates the sharing, promoting of, and advocacy for Indigenous-based initiatives through holistic educational efforts. WIPSI 2025 took place here in Tāmaki Makaurau. I spoke to WIPSI 2025 co-chair, Professor Mehana Jury, Danitane, Ngāti Kaufata, Ngāti Rokawa, Ngāti Porou, Rongo Fukata, and Kai Tahu about his reflections on the conference. I started by asking if he could briefly outline what WIPSI is for those who don't know.
WIPSI is the world's biggest Indigenous education conference that only happens every 3 years, and it was last held in Aotearoa in 2005, hosted by Waikato. So this year's return of WIPSI to Tāmaki Makaurau was significant. It was actually the biggest ever academic conference held in the country. There were over 4,000 participants. WIPSI was open to the city through our Te Ao Pūtahi Festival. So it's significant for those reasons. But I think perhaps more importantly, it's significant because it's a conference and a movement which allows us to determine the future of Indigenous education in the world.
WIPSI this year had a range of themes, but were there any in particular that really shone through?
Well, for me, probably two themes came through strongly right throughout the gathering. But the first one, in my view, is that there's an emerging movement, which is really around what we might call trans-indigeneity. Now, trans-indigeneity is about Indigenous nations, Indigenous movements working much more closely together to establish a standalone Indigenous economy, to establish a standalone Indigenous health system, to establish a standalone Indigenous media platform. So what we're seeing right now, and if we actually reflect back on Te Ariki Nui Kuini Ngāwai Honoi Te Pō, her hui held at Tūranga Waiwai the other week, was all about building a standalone independent economy. So that was one theme. The other theme is that we should celebrate the place of Indigeneity in this world. We wanted to use WIPSI as a platform to open our doors to Aucklanders, to New Zealanders, to anyone and everyone, to get a taste of what it is to be Indigenous in terms of how we go about promoting our culture, our education, our language. So that in itself, I think, is quite remarkable. In 3 years' time, we head to Waikoloa in the Big Island of Hawaii. So we're looking forward to the next WIPSI, which is going to be held in 2028.
A lot of people have talked about how vibrant the city centre felt while the conference was on. Why do you think this was, and how can we keep that energy?
Well, I really applaud the efforts of Ngāti Whātua, who were our iwi manaaki for the duration of WIPSI. We worked very closely with Ngāti Whātua to ensure that their mana could be reflected across the entirety of WIPSI. But right from the Parade of Nations, which was on the Sunday, and this massive, what I call a mega porphyry catering of 3,000 people at the Cloud, it really set the tone for the city, which was to say that, you know, Auckland, we are diverse. Tāmaki Makaurau, let's celebrate our Indigenous, our iwi history. But we should do more of this. We proved to the world that we can host a conference of the scale, one of the biggest ever conferences to take place in Aotearoa. So my message to Tāmaki Makaurau and to Aotearoa is that we should do more of this. Our Indigenous brothers and sisters enjoy coming to Aotearoa. We have a long-standing history of sharing our shared experiences and sharing the vibrancy of our culture. So I think that WIPSI 2025 has really flipped the script, and it shows to the country and to the world that we can do this, and we should do more of it. We should be really proud as a city, actually, in terms of being in Tāmaki Makaurau, of what we can achieve.
Were there any challenges laid out at the conference that people across Aotearoa should keep in mind?
I think there are a number of challenges that are very much reflective of the current political climate here in Aotearoa. One of the recurring messages throughout the conference was that there have been a number of recent decisions made by the current coalition government which diminish the impact of Māori education in this country and diminish the impact of Te Tiriti or Waitangi in this country. The other broader message that really resonated right throughout WPSI 2025 was that Indigenous peoples are having to grapple and negotiate with the impact of what I would call right-wing governments throughout the world who take a view, really, that indigeneity is of no concern to governments and that governments are actually more concerned with the economy. So we need to be able to ensure that those concerns are heard by respective governments across the world and that the challenges that Indigenous peoples face can be overcome because we have the solutions, but we need to also ensure that we are not entirely dependent upon governments to be prescribing what is best for us. In fact, tinoranga tiratanga and Indigenous sovereignty is about Indigenous peoples being self-determining. But I also feel that we need to work much more closely together, and that's really what this notion of trans-Indigeneity is about.
That was Professor Mehana Duri, WPSI 2025 co-chair, on his reflections from the conference.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
A project funded by the Health Research Council has spotlighted the significant gap in support for Asian rangatahi who've experienced sexual violence in Aotearoa. Research investigated the experience of professionals and carers from counsellors, psychologists, educators, social workers, legal and medical practitioners and more from across the motu. Increased cultural competency, safety and support emerge as common themes for a more cohesive cross-sector approach to improve support for survivors. I spoke to the initiative's lead researcher, Dr. Ying Wang, about this kaupapa. Kia ora, could you talk us through an overview of your findings regarding lacking support for Asian sexual violence workers in Aotearoa?
Thank you. Our study found a group of deep caring professionals support young Asian survivors of sexual violence in New Zealand. They work with empathy, safety and trust building, creating spaces for young people of warmth, acceptance and empowerment. The human connections emerged as the most powerful healing element, helping survivors feel respected and supported. However, these professionals operated in a fragmented, under-resourced system. They also face consistent challenges in community, include cultural taboos, family resistance, and fears of dishonor that silence young survivors. And most importantly, we also found many health professionals experience emotional exhaustion, compassion fatigue, and lack structural support. They wanted recognition of their own well-being needs without, you know, the systemic change. The relational depths that help professionals aim to provide is at risk, both for their own well-being and for the quality of care offered for survivors. So the health professionals, they want to be safe, need to be safe to provide safety for the community.
And how can we best support the sustainability of care for these kaimahi, these workers in these fields?
How to start? I'm really feeling the gap as everywhere. The first, I would say we must center young people's voice in service design, and the trauma-informed practice must be youth-led, flexible and responsive to their lived realities. So the workforce needs to have this awareness, need to work with the cross sectors like in research and policy making and in schools. And also we need a cross-sector integrations. For example, education, health, legal system and community services must move beyond the silos to create more joint pathways, what we often call no wrong door approach. So young people can experience continuity rather than a fragmentation in the support system, especially because my research focuses on young survivors from Asian communities. So the cultural responsiveness must be embedded as the core principle, not option. This means recruiting and training Asian professionals, interpreters, and the culture supervisors, while also weaving Asian worldviews and practice into mainstream service framework. I think another point I really want to make is community engagement is so crucial. Outreach and education strategies must address stigma and silence, working alongside families and community leaders to foster collective support for young people's well-being. Of course, we can't ignore the well-being of the workforce. The investment in, I would say, sustained investment in supervision, peer support, and the cultural competency training and emotional support is vital. Without this, burnout will impact service quality and compromise the very relational depths that survival value the most.
And do you have any thoughts on balancing the cultural competency of existing professionals in the sector and the need for a wider representation of diverse ethnicities in the health and education support sectors for sexual violence?
Well, I would say representation of a diverse workforce in health and education support sectors matters, but it's not enough. What is critical is that workforce, regardless of their cultural backgrounds, they can work effectively across cultures. For example, many people from Asian communities don't necessarily want to work with someone from their own community, often because of the privacy concerns in small networks. And for some young people in Asian community, that can be even more tricky, especially when trauma sometimes is tied to cultural norms, their experience in family or community. They may prefer support from someone else, like someone outside their culture, to create a new space for healing and growth. So I would say the cultural competence isn't about knowing every culture, because that's just impossible. It's about skills, awareness, empathy, and ongoing reflection. It can't just rest on individual level. It must be built into the system. We need not just culturally competent individuals, but culturally competent system.
Through the lens of your research, what are your thoughts on Te Ao Rere Kura, our current national strategy, and its suitability for serving that intersectionality and cross-sector collaboration?
Te Ao Rere Kura, the national strategy, provides a strong framework for intersectional cross-sector collaborations, but our research shows the critical gaps for Asian community and the workforce. Asian survivors face unique cultural barriers, like cultural silence, taboo topic, stigma, and family community pressure and so on. So we need a tailored and a culturally responsive interventions and funding for services that understand the Asian cultural needs. Another point is, our study found the limited structural support among helping professionals. Te Ao Rere Kura calls for a skilled workforce, but this requires investment in culturally responsive supervision, peer support, training in cross-cultural practice, and the skills for engaging young people and the marginalized communities. So the efforts are required to enhance the support to provide to our workforce to enable them to effectively perform their caring responsibilities. Another point I wanted to make is cross-sectors collaboration must include Asian voices in policy making and design. Integration across support systems and services will only succeed if equity and inclusivity are the central. So I would say that Te Ao Rere Kura sets the vision, but our practice must value culture responsiveness and systematic competence, also the workforce well-being, to truly support our Asian communities in New Zealand.
And your research findings included original artwork and two original songs. Could you speak about the journey to those being produced?
These two songs actually came from an early project which focused on school-based support for young Asian survivors. So these two songs translate research findings and these young survivors' own voice into creative forms that speak directly to young people in the community who may never read academic reports or articles. So this project, so building on that early project, this current HRC-funded study, wanted to listen to help professionals' lived experience. So in this study, we invited 29 professionals in this study, include doctors, psychologists, counselors, educators, and so on, to reflect on their work through creative methods. For example, using metaphors, drawings, and poetic words. So from these, I created a poetry book from the participants' voice paired with their artwork. Each piece captured the emotional weight of their role and reveals common things through art-based analysis. The creative representation of this study is really powerful because it invites readers from diverse backgrounds to engage this study more emotionally with lived experience and to gain deep emotional insights through storytelling.
That was Dr. Ying Wang, Research Fellow at the Centre for Arts and Social Transformation at the University of Auckland, on her findings about the experiences of Asian communities in the sexual violence support sector and how needs can be better serviced in Aotearoa.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.